Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. Well, this coming Friday, I'm due to begin leading a two-week-long retreat with Joseph Pavakaro, former abbot of Wat Phananachat, my first Dhamma teacher. He's now a layperson, but I have invited him a few times to come back and co-lead retreats with me. So this year, it's a longer retreat than we've done before, and the theme is, What Are You Thinking? The Buddha's Path to Skillful Thought. So speaking of thinking, I thought it might be useful to explore some of those themes this evening, to reflect on some of those areas, particularly because this is a time of the year where people are doing a lot more individual meditation. Many members of the Sangha are engaging in individual retreats, having solo retreat time for 2-3 weeks or a month. And even if not in solo retreat, we're basing our lives here at Amravati mostly around meditation practice and the watching of the mind, training of the mind. And so then the understanding of the realm of thought and thinking and how that fits together with mind training, and particularly peace of mind, and through the understanding, the quality of understanding, of wisdom, and how the liberation of the heart comes about. For many of us, myself included, when first starting out with the efforts of meditation practice, then it's shocking just how much thinking the mind does. We might have had an impression that the mind is chattering away a lot, but when we first sit down and try to focus the attention on the present moment, say maybe following the breath or trying to follow a mantra like Buddho, it's shocking, it's amazing, startling how much thinking the mind does, and just goes on and on and on and on. And then the more that we watch, the more we realize, oh, this thing never seems to shut up. It just goes on and on and on. I'm presuming that's a fairly common experience for most people here. I won't ask for a show of hands, but it's very, very ordinary for us to be having this kind of experience, the mind just chattering away, commenting, worrying, planning, remembering, calculating, figuring things out, and projecting about what I should do, or what other people think of me, or what's going to happen next, or what I should have done differently, or what I might do in the future. So the initial feeling that we have, I certainly had, was if I could just get this thing to be quiet, I would be really happy. And we assume that meditation is to do with making the mind stop thinking. But from the get-go, first instructions that I got in Thailand, and that the emphasis that Ajahn Chah would give was that, yes, the chattering mind, the endless say activity of a thinking mind when it's out of control, that is uncomfortable or oppressive or agitating. But the path of the Buddha and the path of meditation is not just about making the mind stop thinking. As he would often say, like, you know, he would point to one of the forest chickens and say, well, you know, that these chickens don't do a lot of thinking, but they're not liberated. Or pointing to a rock or a concrete block, saying, well, that, you know, that rock doesn't do a lot of thinking, but it's not in a state of liberation. You know, it's not an enlightened mind. There's no thinking going on, but there's no liberation there either. So that sort of praising of the quality of not thinking in and of itself, even though it might seem attractive, that it's important to understand that peace is not just a matter of the mind not thinking. Otherwise, just going to the doctor or going to the street dealer and getting some particular sort of mind stopping drugs, to get some barbiturates or Largactyl or something like that that just stops the mind thinking. That would be the way to liberation. But the Buddha's teaching makes it very clear that it's not just a matter of the mind stopping thinking that is identical with liberation, but rather it's a skillful understanding of thought and a skillful use of thought, and being able to use thought in the proper context. That's the thing that makes the big difference. For myself, it was as I said, it was just a constant chatter. I was only 21 years old when I first went to Wat Phananachat in Thailand, and I'd never really meditated before at all. So it was watching my mind was like watching a speeding train just going at a fearsome pace, hurtling through the countryside, just non-stop. And the idea of it actually ever slowing down or being quiet was a very remote possibility. And I think if I remember the first time I actually noticed, or my mind actually stopped thinking in a conscious way, was like tonight. It was an observance day, and we would have an all-night sitting, so the meditation would go on all night long, and then carry on through until the early hours of the morning. And then I was often the only novice there, so I would make the early morning Ovaltine after the morning puja and the sort of formal observance had finished, and there was an hour or two to spare, and I would scoot off to the kitchen and make the early morning Ovaltine for everybody. So on this particular occasion, I'd been up all night long, and then up all the next day as well. I hadn't had a rest during the day. And then we would have a sauna in the monastery, Chantagara, the sweat house, the night after the observance day. And I used to like to sit in the sauna for a long time and really cook to ease the aching joints and such like. And it was on that evening, so I'd been up all day, the day before, all night long, and all the next day. It was finally the evening. So my whole system was really exhausted. And it was at the end of the time in the sauna, and everyone else had left. And I was sitting there by myself. Suddenly, it hit me. I'm not thinking. It stopped. Just through sheer exhaustion of the whole system. Wow, I've never known my mind to be quiet, even though that was a verbal thought itself. I was thinking, I've never known my mind to be quiet before. There was space and silence. Oh, this is great. I thought, well, if I have to stay up for 48 hours and and sit in a sauna for 2 hours at the end of it in order to make my mind go quiet, this is a bit of a heavy-duty procedure. But as time went by, then, and my sort of time spent practicing meditation and living in the monastery and developed, then it got easier and easier to quieten the mind. And then, that was something that was really pleasant, mostly as a contrast to the chattering activity. But after I'd been in robes for 4 or 5 years, I remember being on a winter retreat, and it was a very small community and very, very, very quiet life, and a lot of formal practice during the days, and so that the mind was a lot more quiet. Yeah. Thank you. And so then it was much more, not just sort of an isolated moment here and there, but for long periods of time, just sitting there not thinking. And then realizing, well, the mind isn't doing any thinking, but this doesn't feel very liberated. In fact, it feels like I'm sitting here in a gray box with nothing going on. It's like watching a TV with no program on it. This is really boring. So there's no thinking going on, but just that absence of thought in and of itself is not something that was liberating. It was quiet. But there was no liveliness there. There was no vitality, no brightness, and no real spaciousness. But there was a quietness, literally like sitting watching a TV that's not switched on. So that just having a mental quietness in and of itself is only part of the story, and if we train the mind to be quiet, then it's very crucial, it's essential that along with that quietness, then there's an exploration and examination of the other aspects of mind, and using the meditation and the particular development of concentration and of wisdom to help, bring about the development of the other qualities that bring about brightness of mind, the sense of spaciousness, limitlessness, and the quality of understanding. So that even though quietness and a stilling of active thinking, of chattering thought is useful, beneficial in and of itself, it's not the whole story by any means. So in terms of thought and the path to skillful thought, then it's helpful to distinguish between what we usually consider thinking, just the chattering of the mind that is planning and remembering and worrying and hoping and fantasizing and calculating. It's the inner monologue that chatters away and carries on. This is what in our Buddhist terminology we call papancha, or conceptual proliferation. So that's what we normally think of as thinking, or what we regard as thinking, that the chattering of the mind. And that in itself is something that is obstructive. It is something that is not liberating or helpful, the inner mental noise. So that kind of thinking is not helpful or skillful or particularly useful. But the other kind of thinking that is not just helpful, but is something that the Buddha spelled out as being an essential condition for liberation, is what's called wise reflection, or yoniso manasikara, also called dhamma vijaya, or investigation of reality. So dhamma vijaya, and yoniso manasikara, this is a whole different quality of thought. This is the use of conceptual thought, the use of the mind's ability to reflect and to explore and to consider as a way of understanding the flow of our experience, to make sense of what we're feeling, what we're seeing, what we're hearing, what the present moment reality is doing, how that's formed, and what's a skillful way to work with it. Oftentimes people ask this question, what's the difference between wise reflection and the chattering mind? And how do you develop, how do you quiet the one and develop the other? So that's an area that's really important to understand and useful to develop. The quality of wise reflection, yoniso manasikara, the way I understand it and use it is it's a quality of attention. It's the conscious use of the mind's ability to recognize patterns, to recognize cause and effect, essentially seeing how things work, so that it's a bringing of attention to the present moment, the present experience, and asking questions like, how is this working? What's going on here? How does this feel? What is the mind assuming here? What is being wanted? What is being feared? What's being, rejected? What's happening here? So it's that investigative quality of the mind. It's like an interest. There's a kind of an enthusiasm. So a chanda, that sense of interest and engagement. And it's the active use of the mind's ability to observe how things work, how things operate, the patterns that are in play within our experience. And particularly, as I said, the cause and effect relationships of why we feel what we do. Why is something attractive, or why is something frightening, or why is something irritating? Why do we call something mine or not mine? Now, that quality of wise reflection, then, if you studied much of Lumpur Cha's teachings, read many of the books of his talks, or if you listen to the if you can understand Thai and hear him speaking in Thai, you'll have noticed that he uses this quality of wise reflection, consideration, to a huge degree. And many of his Dhamma talks, he'll be describing how he picked up a particular experience, or being annoyed by something, or being excited by something, or being frightened by something, and then picking it up and exploring, hey, what's going on here? How come I call myself frightened of that? Why is the idea of a ghost frightening? Or why is that food attractive? Or if I'm calling a mango delicious, if one mango is delicious, then what happens if I eat 10 mangoes or 20 mangoes or 30 mangoes? You know, is it still delicious? Is it still attractive? Is it still interesting? Well, what happens? So over and over again, he picks up his experience, his fears, his desires, his opinions, his memories, his plans, and explores them. And he sort of walks you through it during his Dhamma teachings. So this is, in a way, describing exactly how to skillfully develop wise reflection and to be using that ability that we have, in a way, our own natural intelligence to be picking things up, to be examining, okay, why is this so exciting? Why is this something that is frightening? Why, when I hear that word, do I get upset or irritated, or do I feel alienated? You know, why is there a trigger with that particular word or that sound or that feeling, that sight? What's behind this? How is this working? Now, with wise reflection, what happens is, as any of us who've done much meditation or tried to use this, is that you can start off with yoniso manasikara, and that there can be a conscious and deliberate picking up of a particular experience and the intention to explore it. But then, within about 10 seconds, whoop, you know, you've jumped on the papancha train, the conceptual proliferation has taken off, and you've, in a sense, lost that mindfulness, and the mind's got caught up with a particular reaction or a particular fear or a memory or an idea, and it's lost in the carried away. So that easily happens. So that one of the aspects of developing this mindful quality of thinking or wise reflection is to develop an awareness or an appreciation of the pace of it, or the tone of it. Because when it's genuine wise reflection, then we think in whole sentences, and there's spaces between the sentences. So the mind might ask, you know, why is this interesting? Or why is this something that is frightening? Where does that come from? The sentence has a beginning and a middle and an end. You know, why is this frightening? Where does this come from? It's a whole sentence, then there's a pause. Oh. Well, maybe it's frightening because and when I go on the arms round and I hear the sound of a dog barking, I feel tension and fear because maybe it's something from a childhood memory. Maybe that's where it comes from. A whole sentence, a pause. Ah, that's right, that's right. When I was a child, I was always frightened of dogs. And I hadn't been around places where I've seen dogs or met dogs for a long time. But now here I am on the arms round, I hear the sound of the dogs barking, and then it brings about this reaction. Aha, maybe that's it. So just using that as a random example, so that the mind is picking up a theme, it's exploring it, say examining what it, the causes might be and where things, how things are formed, but the mind is thinking in discrete sentences, there's spaces between them, there's a measured, even quality, there's a steadiness in the tone of thinking when it is genuine, wise reflection. When the mind is caught into papancha, conceptual proliferation, when it's sort of jumped on a particular feeling, then we don't think in whole sentences, it's just one idea just chases after another and sort of fragmented thoughts when following along half-formed after another. There's no evenness, there's no steadiness there. The mind is just racing away and is kind of lost in a fragmented and very busy chain of associations, just one thing following another after another. And the attention is absorbed in that chain of mental reactions. So there's an agitation, there's a busyness, there's a stressfulness in that. And as in the teachings that talk about papancha, you end up with this what's called papancha sanya sankhara, which is that feeling of being oppressed, me being oppressed by the world, me chasing after something that I haven't got, me fighting against something that is annoying, or me running away from something that is frightening. That sense of an I in a state of tension and oppression, a state of conflict with an outside world. That's the end result of papancha, is kind of me in a state of pressure and tension with the world. So if we develop the quality of wise reflection, then thought is being applied in a skillful way. And that thought is not an intrusion upon our peace of mind. Just yesterday, someone was asking me about meditation and how to stop thinking. And the main theme of what they were asking was that was based on the assumption of, well, if you're thinking that, then that's not meditation, or that can't be peaceful. And this is a really common assumption, or and I would say misunderstanding, because thought is just another sense object. So just as the eye sees form, like I'm looking out over the interior of the temple at Amravati here, I see the oak pillars, I see the floor, I see the people, I see the monks here, and the laymen at the back here, I see the nuns here, and the laywomen at the back there. There's the space of the hall. I see visual forms. I hear the sound of my voice speaking. So the mind can appreciate seeing, hearing. I feel the weight of my body on the cushion of the Dhamma seat, the sense of the touch of the sensation of the cloth of my robes on my skin. There's a feeling of physical sensation. So the mind can know those sense impressions without any kind of dukkha, any kind of suffering or any kind of wrongness associated with that. The eye perceives form, the ear perceives sound, The nose perceives odors, the tongue perceives flavors, the body perceives sensations, and the mind perceives thoughts and emotions and feelings, memories, ideas. So thought is just a sense object, physical form, like sound, like smell and taste and touch. So just as the mind can appreciate sense objects from the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, then it can appreciate a sense object from the mind. There's no reason why a thought needs to be an intrusion upon the peace of mind. Now, usually we assume that if there is a thought there, then we can't be peaceful. That's an intrusion on the meditation. It's an intrusion upon our peace. And that's usually because as soon as a single thought appears, then whoop, the whole papuncha train gets going and the mind goes racing off and gets lost in its own conceptual creations. But in and of itself, just like you can open your eyes and you can see oak pillars, you can see limestone tiles, you can see monk sitting on mat, and not create any suffering about it. It's just seeing, just feeling the sensation of wood under the fingertips. Just seeing, feeling, hearing. That's all. There's no dukkha involved in that. So why should there necessarily be dukkha involved in the mind appreciating the form of a conceptual thought? So that, I feel, is again a very helpful way of rejigging our understanding, that just because there's a thought doesn't mean to say that the meditation has been broken or that we're not paying attention. It's just the mind can know thought and be fully aware this is a thought. So as part of the development of yoni so manasikara, wise reflection, then training ourselves to think consciously and to be aware of thought and not get lost in thought is a really useful skill. And this is something that that Lumpo Sumato used to teach quite regularly when he was the abbot here and running meditation retreats and giving Dhamma talks, particularly during the winter retreats here. At least my experience of that back in the 80s and early 90s. So he would give a very, very simple, straightforward instruction. So to develop the ability to be aware of thought without getting lost in it, you train yourself. He would give us these little exercises to do. And he'd take some particularly non-personal, simple thought, like, today is Monday. That's not personal for anybody. Well, pretty likely not to be a personal thought. It's not emotionally loaded. It's very simple, practical, non-personal. And so you bring the mind to a quality of quietness, make the mind as still and as quiet as possible, and then just consciously think, today is Monday. You notice the space before the thought, and then the thought, today is Monday, and the space after the thought. And then as that's being developed, as you carry out that exercise, then in that very moment we can notice, oh, there's the thought, today is Monday, but that is clearly known, just like the shape of a pillar or the sensation of wood under the fingers. It's a sense object that's known. That's all. It comes into being. The thought begins. It has its shape. Today is Monday. Then it comes to an end. Just like touching the wood of the Dhamma seat. There's a space before it's touched. There's the sensation of it being touched, and then there's the absence of that touch after my hand leaves it. That's all. A sense object arises and passes away. In this instance, it just happens to be a conceptual thought. So that might seem like a bit of a waste of time. Like, am I supposed to sit there for an hour thinking today is Monday? But it's an exercise that we can do for the very particular purpose in mind. So that if we do that with deliberately constructed thoughts, and then with things that are not personal, they're not about me, they're not about others, they're not anything that's emotionally loaded, or the mind can create a lot of doubt or worry about. It's as benign and simple, straightforward as possible. Then we're developing the skill around these very simple, tangible objects like that. Then once you develop that skill, then with that which is benign and easily seen, then you find that skill is still there when the objects, the thoughts, are more emotionally charged, and also when they arise on their own. They're not something that has necessarily been crafted. So this is a way of training the mind to use thought, to be applying a conceptual thought to examine, to explore the present moment experience without getting lost in it, so that you can raise the conceptual thought. You can use that investigation. Why do I feel afraid of this? Or why is that exciting? Or that's interesting. I call this beautiful and I call that ugly. Where is the beauty? Where is the ugliness? Where does that come from? What's the cause of that? And that you can be aware of those thoughts, know them fully without getting lost in them, without getting carried away, and then the process of wise reflection can really bear fruit, because what you're doing is you're drawing upon your own wisdom. You're using conceptual thought not to just sort of calculate your way to an answer, but rather you're using that wise reflection, that conceptual thought, as a kind of catalyst. It's using it to awaken your own wisdom, to draw upon your own understanding, that in you which in a sense already has an understanding of what's going on and how it works, but that hasn't taken form, that's not clear, that's not something that's come into being yet. So in a sense, wise reflection is like consulting your own oracle. It's like going to the source of wisdom, and so that you are, say, allowing your own profound understanding, your own intuitive wisdom, your intuitive understanding to manifest, to take shape, and to crystallize, to be known, to be visible, and so that you're, say, using your own faculty of understanding and helping it to be fulfilled. So, as I said, far from conceptual thought and that being something that's an obstruction to enlightenment, or oftentimes people relate to thinking like some kind of brain disease. I could just stop this incessant chatter, then I would be really happy. It's like some kind of illness that we've got to get rid of. But rather, if we change the way that we relate to thought, and particularly if this capacity of wise reflection is developed, then this becomes the most powerful tool. This is one of the bases of stream entry, one of the four necessary conditions for stream entry is wise reflection. You know, the first one is drawing close to good people, sapurisa sangseva, spending time with good people, drawing close to wise and noble, good-hearted people. The second is listening to the true Dhamma, sadhamma savana, Dhamma savana, to listen to the Dhamma. And the third is yoniso manasikara, is wise reflection. And then the fourth is practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, dhammanu dhamma patipada. So that that wise reflection is a necessary condition for stream entry. If the heart is to truly awaken, to be liberated, it needs that capacity of wise reflection. In a sense, you can't do without it. If liberation is what is the aim, if that is the goal, of our efforts and our lives, then that quality of wise reflection is a necessary condition. It needs to be there. So if you have an inclination towards just trying to stop thinking to find peace, then to recognize, well, it's not it's not the thought that's the problem. It's the lack of orderliness, the lack of evenness, the lack of integration in the way that thought is used. So rather than being a brain disease or a problem or obstruction, we find that the capacity to think clearly, to be able to reflect wisely, to recognize the patterns of how the universe works, the universe of the mind, the body, the world, that is our greatest friend. That's our most powerful tool. It's a wonderful resource that we have. So rather than just trying to switch it off and not think or not be using that, to instead recognize that if this is a tool that is handled in a skillful way, it'll be of immense benefit. Well, another of the aspects of thinking that the Buddha pointed to, and that I feel is a very, very helpful teaching, is a sutta in the Middle Length Discourses, sutta number 19, if I remember correctly, which is called The Two Kinds of Thinking. Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, Two Kinds of Thinking. And it's the Buddha describing his own practice before his enlightenment. And he says that what he did with his meditation was that he divided his thoughts into two categories. As he was meditating and watching his mind, then he made this distinction, this discrimination. So the thoughts that were unskillful, that were based on selfishness, or based on aversion, or based on delusion, or sense desire, then they were clearly labeled as unskillful, and that they were deliberately put aside. So there's a recognition of this is a thought connected with sense desire. It's connected with selfishness. It's connected with ill will, with laziness, with aversion, with unwholesome states. Therefore, that is something to be known and to be let go of, not to be fed or not to be sustained or supported. And then the other category of thinking is thoughts that were connected with unselfishness, with kindness, with compassion, with freedom from ill will and sense desire, thoughts connected with renunciation, simplicity, and so forth. And those were recognized as being wholesome, as being noble, as being beneficial. And those were deliberately sustained, maintained, and encouraged. And so, and as he says in that sutta, because what the mind frequently ponders upon, what we put our attention on, that becomes the tendency of the mind. So, if your tendency of the mind is to always be complaining and finding fault, if the mind is inclined towards negativity, if that's not recognized, then that's a rut that gets created. That's the track the mind's going to go down. That your relationship to the world will be based on complaining. That whatever the mind frequently dwells and ponders upon, that will be the inclination of the mind. So if you look around the temple and you think, well, that pillar's not really straight, and I don't like the gilding they did on the Buddha image, and those flower arrangements, they're not as good as this week as they were last week, and we should have more candles or less candles or. Etc., etc., etc. Everything you look at, the mind sees what's wrong with it. That if that's what you've done with your mind, that's what you'll see. The world will be a constant cause for complaint. The mind will see will just see things in terms of what's wrong with them. The glass half empty. The glass half full say the mind, if it's inclined towards appreciation and gratitude, then instead, oh, this is really, this temple is so wonderful. This what a fantastic design, what a beautiful space it makes for us. And I'm so glad that people are really gifted at flower arrangement. These are so beautiful. It makes the temple such an inspiring place. And the golden colored Buddha in the center is a beautiful, inspiring figure, etc., etc. If the mind is seeing things in terms of appreciation, of gratitude, of a track of unselfishness and positivity, that will be the inclination of the mind. And if we are, say, aware of that, then it's a very simple process. If we can recognize, oh, if my mind dwells upon this, not just with complaining, obviously with sense desire, or what I can get out of this situation, what I'm going to get in the future, what I want to have, what's going to make me happy in the future when I get it, or worrying, oh dear, what's going to happen to me? How am I going to deal with this? Oh, I've got this problem to solve and I don't know how to work with it. Oh dear, what am I going to do? If we don't recognize those habits, then the mind will just keep following those tracks. Whatever the mind frequently attends to, thinks and ponders upon, that will be its inclination. So if we recognize that, and then we say, okay, that's a negative direction that leads towards stress, that leads towards tension, that leads towards conflict within myself and between myself and others. Therefore, let's not go down that track. Let's steer the mind down a different track. And if you see that the track is something that's wholesome and beneficial, that leads towards peacefulness, that leads towards clarity, that leads towards brightness and appreciation, that leads towards simplicity and a lack of neediness, then take that direction. And then the Buddha gave this very, very beautiful analogy. He said also, when there are unwholesome mind states that are dominating, then you need to be really careful. You need to be paying close attention because you can cause yourself and others a lot of harm by just letting the mind move in negative directions. But if the mind is moving if its tendency is in positive directions, then you can have a bit more of a relaxed attitude. And he uses this image of looking after cows in the countryside. If you're a cow herd or you're tending the cows, as it would be the case in a village in India or Nepal in his own lifetime, he said that if the mind is dominated by negative mind states, then it's like if you're looking after the cows during the rainy season and the crops are growing in the field, you have to pay close attention because if the cows wander into the rice fields and they start chewing on the rice seedlings and they start devouring the crops, then you're going to get punished and the owners of the crops will be upset and this could be very painful and difficult for you and is to be avoided. So as soon as you see the cows sort of drifting into the crops, you kind of go on and you kind of shout at them and get them out of the crops and back onto the verges in the woods where they can graze freely from and browse from the trees and the verges where it's okay to eat. So you need to be paying close attention, and as soon as the cows wander off into the crops, then you're right on it. You tap them on the neck or the backside and steer them away from that. So that if the mind is inclined towards wholesome states, then it's like looking after the cows in the hot season. All the crops have grown up and they've already been gathered in. The rice is all in the barns and there's no crops in the fields. And so you can kind of lie under a tree in the shade and have a snooze and let the cows wander wherever they want because they can't do any harm. There's no danger from what they do. So there's no need to be too attentive or too worried, because if it's wholesome states that the mind is following, then it's nothing damaging or difficult or painful is going to come from that. So this is the imagery that he uses to describe these these two, say, qualities. But I feel this is a simple teaching, and you know, as we hear it, we think, well, that's kind of easy, you know, okay, wholesome, follow it, unwholesome, don't follow it. Yeah, okay, I understand that. And yeah, the principle is very simple to understand, but we don't do it, do we? We very easily just follow those ruts, wherever the track is heavily worn. That's where our feet tend to go. That's where we follow. And how many of us, either in ourselves, know that the mind is always going towards worry, or is always going towards, say, self-concern, you know, about what's in this for me, or what can I get, or what do I feel, or what's my opinion? Or in other people, that you know, being around others, and you're noticing that they've always got their own kind of opinion, that they've always got to be in charge, or they've always got to have their own way, and it's very kind of shocking or striking how the mind has a favored track to go down. So. In this practice, then noticing what are the tracks, what are the ruts that our mind follows, you know, where, what is its favored directions. And if it goes down those tracks of, say, of worry or fear or self-criticism, or that, as Ajahn Viradhamma used to refer to his own mental habits of self-hatred, self-criticism, he called it the I'm no good mantra. That he'd hear his mind going, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good, I'm no good. Or the opposite would be like, you know, I'm wonderful, I'm wonderful, I'm wonderful. You're so lucky to have me around, I'm wonderful. Yeah, look at me, I'm great, I'm so fantastic. You people are really lucky to have me around. Yeah, I'm really something special. So to be aware of those ruts, to bring attention, to be watching, to use that quality of wise reflection. And say, isn't that interesting? My mind always finds something to complain about. Or like for myself, I was a real worrier. I was not a hatred type. I very rarely experienced any kind of anger or hatred. But I could worry about anything and everything. And so when I saw other people getting angry or upset, it was be like, oh, strange. Because my mind wouldn't do that, but it would find any reason to worry about anything, whether it would involve me or not. It would just create worry. So in developing this practice and using wise reflection, notice the ruts that are formed, whether you like to explain everything or you just like to say, you know, you're worried about things, or you're trying to get things, and you're a greedy type. You're trying to just have, you know, pleasant experiences or get more stuff. Notice it. Be aware of those unskillful tendencies. Name them. Get a kind of a picture of them. Yeah, to articulate. Give it a form in your mind. Just recognize. Oh, that's a habit I have. I'm always trying to figure things out. I'm always trying to have my own way, or I'm afraid of making decisions, or whatever it might be. You know, get to know your own habits. Give them a name. Spell it out to yourself what the habit is. Clarify what's there, and then as that's clarified, then we can know it more completely, more directly as it arises. Similarly, the wholesome habits, not to make ourselves conceited or proud because of the good qualities, but to look, say, okay, yeah, I am compassionate. I do care for the feelings of others. That's a beautiful thing. It doesn't have to be something that the mind creates conceit or ego around, but oh, that compassionate tendency, that has a good quality to it. People appreciate that kindness, that compassion that is shown to them. That makes a warm feeling between myself and others. It makes a deep friendship between myself and others. Look at that. See the result of that. Know that. acts of generosity, acts of unselfishness, and so on. To notice, okay, that's a habit, that's a skillful direction. If it's followed, look what good comes from it. Look at the beautiful, noble, liberating qualities that come from that. Aha, look at that. So we get to know those tracks of the mind, the directions that the mind can take, and getting familiar with them, using wise reflection to clarify, to articulate, to give a name, a description of those. And through that describing and knowing and naming, then what's unwholesome, what's leads towards harm and confusion, alienation and dukkha, let go of it. Steer away from that. Don't give that energy. And keep the cows out of the crops. You know, just steer the mind away from those tracks to recognize, I know where this goes. This goes to painfulness for myself and for others. Okay, just take a left. You know, get out of that rut. And then the qualities that are wholesome and noble, yes, give them strength. You know, feed them, support them. Yeah, that's a good track. Develop that path. Develop that track. You know, make it firmer, stronger, wider to help the mind to go down that for your benefit, for the benefit of those that you live with and spend your time with. So these are a few themes. On what we're thinking, on pathways of skillful thought. So whatever is useful, then please take it and use it. Whatever is not useful, please leave it aside. Anyone?